Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Turning a thought into reality is what drives me the most.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 157, a talk with Mr. Fab. Fab is a Bay Area rapper who has been a key part of his region's scene for well over a decade. His albums like Son of a Pimp and DaBayDestrian, as well as his successes as a freestyle rhymer and a battle rapper, have showed him to be an incredibly versatile artist. He's equally at home writing tear-jerking songs about his family, improvising for 10 minutes at a time to whatever beat is thrown at him, or attacking an opponent with a vicious battle rhyme. He was also a key part of the Bay Area's hyphy movement, which had its moment in the national spotlight in the mid to late 2000s. Mr. Fab's brand new album, out this past Friday, May 27th, is Son of a Pimp 2. We caught up to him at the Dream Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with another Bay Area icon, Boots Riley of The Coup, on episode 26. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to on the air and in the wider world. A little note to our regular listeners. Last week, we announced that Nice and Smooth would be our guests for this episode. Not to worry, they'll appear next week. And now, here's Fabby Davis Jr. himself, Mr. Fab. Here with Fabby Davis Jr., the president of the Nation of Thizlam.
Yes, law.
Mr. Fab. So, you know, I wanted to start, I was listening right before I got here to an old interview you did around the time of the first Son of a Pimp. You kind of talked about Bay Area rap and you talked about how it has this, you called it the revolutionary side and the pimpin' side. Can you talk about that a little bit in relation to Bay Area and like specifically you and your life and your sound?
Well, the Bay Area has been a melting pot for several different genres and several different movements of all things, social movements, musical movements. Even when we talk about the innovative approach that it took with sports, the Raiders were the team that, you know, had all the outlaws in the league, you know, so they would be like, okay, you don't want them, we'll take them. The A's allowed the facial hairs and, you know, the radical things from just what the rest of the league wasn't accepting at that time. In the 60s and the 70s, there were two prominent movements that sparked there. One of them would be the culture of the Black Panther, of social identity, of social reform.
Which you have some family connection to.
Most definitely. Some of my uncles and my great uncles were super involved in the Black Panthers and the conscious movement of the re-identifying young Black America with its blackness. Pro-black doesn't necessarily mean anti-white. But what it is was we have to accept our consciousness and understand what we were going through and what we had been through to provide a better sight to see for us. And then on the flip side of the Panthers and the redevelopment of the community, there sparked the pimping side of things, to where it would be like if you had a family of brothers and one of your uncles was a pimp, one of your uncles was a Panther. And they would always argue and they would fight because everything that the Panthers were trying to rid of the community, the pimping was putting back into it, the exploitation of women, the lifestyle, and so on and so forth. So when you look at the 60s and the 70s and they come together, and the child that comes from that in the 80s and the 90s has both of those like chemical balances. So you get certain things. You get a Oakland that you may have someone who's totally super educated on social reform and of who he is, and then on the flip side, he may just be so excited and about the game, you know, the street game, that he's doing both. And he's like, yeah, my brother, yeah, I'm a pimp, but I don't pimp black women. You know, I pimp the hoes, man, you know, white girls, man. So it's just be like, man, bro, you confuse radicals, man. So, but that's just the life and the climate of the melting pot of being from Oakland.
I think that's reflected in your music even more than a lot of the Bay Area people will be, you know, sort of a lot on one side or the other, right? You'll have,
right,
you know, Too Short and the Coup or whatever.
Right,
you know,
right.
Communists and the kind of like Uber pimp, and you've tended to kind of go back and forth and kind of try to meld them, I think, in what you've done.
What I've always done, I've never shied away from who I am and what I am, and what I am is someone who's growing and has yet to figure out myself in its entirety. There still is an it within the it of yourself that you have to discover, which is spawned from Hegel's philosophy, discovering the it within itself as an individual. So as a man, as you grow in the maturation of yourself, you have to continue to cultivate a better thesis of who you actually are, and you're learning. So never put a ceiling on the identification of who you actually are, because there's still time to grow, and there's still, as you living, a living organism continues to evolve, and through those evolving, there are things that you learn about yourself, and you're allowed to be open for yourself. And so I always just spoke in my music about all the different facets of me, the different characteristics of things that I see, things that I've witnessed, things that I've been exposed to, and the expounding of it is a further development of self.
Yeah, and a lot of that, you know, has to do with your family. It seems like your second album, the original Son of a Pimp, was a lot about you rediscovering and thinking about your relationship with your father.
My daddy died when I was 1-2. I'm thankful for ever getting a chance to know you. Coolest guy in the world, always stay fly, stay smart, look sharp, even when he got high. And he taught me.
When you came to the end of that process of like writing the album, releasing it, talking about it, did you think any differently about your time with your dad?
I mean, my dad died at 12 years old.
Right.
So there were certain jewels that couldn't be passed down to me just based off the fact that I was so young, and you have to be cautious of feeding a child steak. You make sure the meat is minced to a point of you can digest it and understand it. And metaphorically, what I'm saying with that is there are certain things that I'm pretty sure that he wished he would have been able to share with me, but it was just too young for me to understand. So I remember precious moments with my father. I remember the good times, the baseball games, the playing catch, the laughing, the watching videos, the walking around the corner, going to get my brother and my two sisters and having us family moments, like those small things that as you get older, they pop up in your mind where you like, my grandmother stayed here and my sisters and my brother stayed right around the corner. And it was crazy that for us to be so close, we still were so distant in our separate households and our upbringing. But on occasions, it would be times where we all would come together and it would all be, you know, something dope. And Pops was a good guy, man. It's just the situations that happen in life, they all affect us differently. And it turns out the trajectory of which way we go in life.
Yeah. And on that album, you, I think, pretty consciously put If Papa Was Home right before Mama's Song. Can you talk about that sequencing?
Chronologically, how the sequence of that project was, definitely everything makes sense. I think you have to have an album when sequencing an album, it has to flow. The story has to be very vivid. What I wanted to do with that was, you know, if Papa was home and Mama ain't worked so long, you know.
If Papa was home and Mama ain't worked
maybe the way that it turned out would have been different. I look at a lot of my friends, and growing up, some of my friends who were phenomenal athletes, but just didn't have that drive, just didn't have that extra push. If their fathers were in their house, maybe they would have had that push. I watched those who had fathers, and then I watched those who didn't. It's a good statistics of those who had fathers end out better on the, you know, the successful rate. And that was just a question to myself of saying, damn, maybe if my dad was alive or involved in my life, certain things would be different. Not only for me, but for my brothers and for my sisters. Mm-hmm. But you learn to deal with the knives that life throw at you.
Mm-hmm. And then as a counterpart to that, you know, you had the Mama's Song afterwards paying tribute to your mother.
So this is for my mama, boy. I'm a only child, so hell yeah, I'm a mama's boy. 22 years, it's only been me and my mama, boy. That's when I blow, I'ma take care of my mama, boy. Cause even as a crack fiend, mama, you always was a black queen, and I'm getting closer.
My mother was the greatest individual on earth in my eyes.
Yeah.
And I was saying, you know, yeah, if dad was home, things would have been different, but mom did a hell of a job keeping it together by herself, you know. But I'm still a firm believer in it takes a village to raise a child. So anyone who ever had anything to do with the contribution of the cultivation of me as an individual, I pay homage to, and I'm thankful and grateful for that, because it's hard raising a young male in today's world.
And speaking of people who have cultivated you, at least career-wise, who were Jazzy Jim and Gary Archer, and what role did they play in your career?
Jazzy Jim was the first guy to financially say, I believe in you. I'm going to put up whatever needs to be done to get the ball rolling.
And for people who aren't from the Bay, he was a radio guy?
He still is a radio guy.
Still is a radio guy.
Jazzy is a super huge radio guy when it comes to breaking records. At that time, like, Jazzy had broke some of the biggest records across the country, from Nelly to NSYNC to everything. You know, Jazzy was that guy. And for him to take the chance with a rap record, like, he was more so considered a pop DJ on the pop station. For him to say, I'm going to take this guy from Oakland, was such an eyebrow raiser to a lot of people around the world. Around the Bay at that time, it was just like, yo, Jazzy's doing rap record. Jazzy has a rap artist, because he had like some crossover artists and some a group called I think Interlude, and I can't think of the other group that he had. But it was just crazy to see him doing that kind of, you know, particular music and putting his name on it. So. Forever till the, you know, till it's over, I'll always be grateful for Jazzy. And Gary was the day-to-day on point guy. Like, Gary was like my Bundini. And Bundini was Muhammad Ali's right-hand man, his corner man. That's who Jamie Foxx played in Ali.
He understands me. He understands me, and he still allows me to hang with him. He knows that I like pork and white women, but he still allows me to be here with him. Now, I can give up pork. But them white women, goddammit. How you deal with it, boy?
And still to this day, Gary was my motivational speaker. The guy that would come grab me at 7, 8 in the morning, go to the studio, and come on, Fab, you're falling off. You got to get in there. You know, he's, till this day, he's that guy that will call me at 6 in the morning like, you sleeping? You sleep? Like, come on, man. We got to get to it, man. We got to get to it, baby. And so for the Archers, I'll always have nothing but the utmost respect for what they were able to do in the early stages of my career.
Yeah. And that very first album of yours, the Nig Latin record, right. There's a couple songs. There's a song toward the end specifically about this, and then somewhere in the middle, you kind of do it in the middle of a verse. You break down some Bay Area slang on it, which got me thinking, like, were you conscious of thinking, oh, I have to appeal to people outside the Bay while you were making that?
No, I never really cared about any of that. Nig Latin was, I heard a record by Big L called Ebonics, and I was just blew away by how he was able to translate New York literal terms and the global sense and give it to the rest of the world.
Pay attention and listen real closely how I break the slang shit down. Check it, my weed smoke is my lie, a key of coke is a pie. When I'm lifted, I'm high, with new clothes on, I'm fly. Cars is whips and sneakers is kicks, money is chips, movies is flips, also cribs is homes.
And I was like, the Bay Area is so misunderstood when we talk to people. Let me do a record like that. You know, let me talk about what's some things that we say, because we'll be mid-conversation with something. We may say something that go right over somebody's head, and they're like, what did you say? So I wanted to do that record on that project. And that was actually the title. That song was actually called Nig Latin.
You got your Ebonics.
Yeah.
You got your Pig Latin.
Uh-huh.
This Nig Latin.
Real high. Real high.
Put it down, is what you say when you check a chick. Give me some hook, man. That's 3 sacks of 25th. Floating is high. Ducky is fire. Doom Doom's a long blunt. Y'all are not the stone stunt. A punkster, a pussy. A J-Cat, a wussy. $100 bill, that's a tootsie. Flipping is the turnover truck.
That was the title to that album, man. That's, yeah.
Yeah. And that record has a whole bunch of different kinds of songs. And Worries, since we're talking about your family a second ago, Worries on that record is at least in part about breaking cycles, right? Breaking patterns of behavior.
Right.
But most of my days I've been stressed and burnt out. Think about my life and wonder how it was gonna turn out. Take a fall like my dad, be locked up like my brother. Or worry and stress myself out like my mother. I got worries.
And, you know, it's been 10 years since you made that song.
It's been longer than that.
Longer than that?
It's been about, I think I did that song in like 2002, 2001. Oh, wow. So
looking back on, you know, 15 years or so since you made that song, do you feel like you personally have been able to make the kind of break from the patterns you were talking about on that tune?
I think I watched my mom worry about so much stuff she couldn't change. So my attitude towards a lot of things are very nonchalant, like, especially like when dealing with women, certain things like that, like women, like they'd be like, yo, you act like you don't care about nothing. And I just be like, man, I've been through so much in my life. Small things don't bother me. Things that I know I have no ability to change or dictate the way that it moves or that it will go or grow, I don't worry about it. So I just approach things with a nonchalant attitude, because I watched my mom worry herself damn near to death about small things, meticulous things. Money was always an issue. You know, I never want to stress off money. Like, out of all the things in the world that you could be thinking about, I never want money to be one of my issues that force me to go gray or force me to, you know, money, something that they print every day. Nah, man. I was like, nah, I'm not going to allow those worries to be my issues. So I definitely feel as if I've broke that chain and that cycle of thinking and that pattern of living life. Definitely didn't take the route that my brother took, my older brother took.
Right.
Didn't take the route that my father took. Took a lot from my mother as far as resilience, grind, motivation, ambition. But one thing that I won't take from her is the worrying stage.
And one or two more things about that album, because I really do love that debut record. Where on earth did Beaver Duck come from? Is that
I don't want no beaver duck. You can have that chick.
I want a lava hottie that is stacking cash and chips.
I don't want no beaver duck. You can keep that there.
Give me a wife that ain't hot and do a thing with a blouse.
I don't want no beaver duck. It's just a dang mess.
She just got a baby. No games of stress.
5'9", 12 drop a dude name on your chest.
Hell no, Beaver Duck ain't passing my test.
Was that something people were saying? Did you make that up? Like,
We was just clowning one day in the studio, cracking jokes, man. And I was like, man, she looked like a beaver duck. And my dude was like, a what? I'm like, bro, just imagine a beaver and a duck put together, bro. Like, you know what I'm saying? That's what she looked like, bro. Oh, platypus face looking. So it was just something we was clowning, and he was like, dude, you should do a song about that. Man, you got to think, bro. I was like 18, 19 recording that album. So I was just young and just having fun. It was just like, whatever.
Yeah.
Louis was in the studio and said that, and Wynn did a song about it, man. That's funny you brought that song up. That's crazy.
Yeah. But that record didn't sell a lot. I heard a song you did called Start Over, where you were like, I was disappointed in the sales, so I changed my style after that record.
First album, 5,000, man, it barely sold. Had me thinking in my head, what did I ever go? So I stop. Reinvented. Came back to Stabby Davis, see why I did it. Cause I knew that
that my style was too far advanced. Dumbed down my style, catered to the fans.
How did you change what you were doing?
I wouldn't say so much changed. I just realized, man, that you can't be the one that tries to go against the machine if you don't have the artillery to defeat the machine. Tupac said, you can't go to war until your money is right.
Just remember what you told me. You said, don't go to war unless I got my money right. I got my money right. Now I want war.
And I never understood that when I was young listening to him. I just felt like it was like, yeah, you can't go to war until your money right. Like, well, I was just in the vibe of it, caught in the moment. But as I got older, I was able to realize what he was saying. War costs. War is very expensive. We talk about building artillery. We talk about the weapons, shelter, you know, being able to be evasive. These are all things that cost in war. And so you can't expect to go to war with someone if you don't have your money up. Segwaying that to, you can't expect to make conscious music or music that goes against the popular genres or the popular in crowd without having a machine behind you that's going to push that issue. Like a Kendrick Lamar, a J. Cole, you know, great artists, very, very, very talented, very dope. But would they have that impact if they didn't have the Dr. Dre's behind them, the Jay-Z's behind them? You know what I mean? The top dog behind them, where these guys are, they're pushing them.
Yeah. Or, you know, another example that comes to mind is, you know, Beyonce, who spent 10 years putting out pop songs and then puts out a thesis album about black women in America.
Now it's the greatest thing in the world. Like, you know what I'm saying? So you have to have that machine. Once you get that, then you could do what you want to do. You know what I mean? You could do what you want to do. You could make music about, like, let's say if Dead Prez had a machine behind them, like, how huge would they be? Like, if Dead Prez had Jay-Z behind them or a Diddy behind them pushing that kind of music, like, that would be crazy. But they don't. So they have to deal with, you know, respecting the fan base that they have, which is great because that's one of my favorite groups ever.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're at that point yet where you can kind of do
but
everything you want?
I'm cool because I don't care if a record sells whatever it sells. I don't need to sell a miraculous amount of records. You know, financially, I'm cool. I don't really need much, you know. Long as my daughter has whatever she wants and, you know, I'm good. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of them people that need to have everything, like 2, 3, 4 of everything. I'm good. I'm chilling. I love shoes. I'm a simple man. I'm like a complex simple man, if that oxymoron makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's, I don't need much like that, man. So I don't care if I sell 3, 4, 5 thousand or if I sell 50,000. It don't matter. I'm going to still be cool because this is just one check. I have several other different ventures that's going to bring some money in.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, you've done a couple mixtapes that are completely improvised, right? The, what is it, Real Shit I Never Wrote
Real Shit
series.
I Never Wrote. Yeah.
Real Shit I Never Wrote, Part 2. Yeah. Robbie, tell them like this one. All I need is one mic, one love, one hug, one thug, $1, one buzz, one nigga to get in my face, just the front cuz niggas know.
Probably some other stuff I'm not remembering offhand. You know, there's a couple of the freestyles that you did that I wanted to talk about, and one of them was the Never Never one. I don't even know if you remember it.
Of course I do. You have to talk about it. Maybe it'll come to mind.
But it's the one where you talk about literally finding your father's body.
Walked in my daddy's room, only to smell death, only to see death. I don't want to see death. I just repeat. I just close my eyes, try to go deep sleep. I just hope that I was dreaming. I just hope that this was not what I was seeing. What I was seeing.
I was curious about what it was like to talk about something that personal while in your head being like, okay, I have to make this rhyme.
I don't even remember that record. Like, but I'm a personal person. I feel when I'm in a studio, I'm talking to the world. Because at any given time, anybody around the world can hear this. When I'm no longer doing music and when I'm no longer even in existence, I want people to review my music and go over my catalog and say, one thing about this dude is he always spoke about what he truly felt, how he truly felt. He always gave us him. My life has been an open book to the fans, to the critics, to media, my whole career. I've never shielded anything away from them. So it's natural for a person who's never met me to feel as if they know me when they come, when they see me or when they encounter me.
Is that weird at all that people come up to you and you know that, like, if they're a fan, they know your entire family history, they know your childhood friends?
Nah, because that's dope to me. And the reason is that's let me know that I'm actually doing what I set out to do, to let the world know about my legacy, let the world know about my status and my where I come from and what I've gone through and where I've gone. And that's what keeps you forever young, because people will continue to talk about you forever and ever and ever. Whether you believe in Jesus or not, the story alone of Jesus is so intriguing that they'll continue to talk about it. The story of Muhammad is very intriguing. Buddha, so on and so forth, if you get what I'm saying. And in no form or fashion am I trying to compare myself to these prophets. But the length of conversation is timeless and endless because so much of their lives have been devoted to the public through their teaching, through the following, and through their messages that they spewed. And in music, I feel as artists, we have prophetic ability to do so. Some of our favorites, we consider them more than just our favorite rappers. They've been our mentors. They've been our motivation. And some of them have even been our prophets. They like to coin Tupac the Black Jesus. And I'm not against that, because there were so many things that related to his story that I identified religiously with. So I just continue to tell my story. And in time, others will tell it for you.
Yeah. And someone whose story you told who wasn't around to tell his own story was Monty Hall. You did a whole song, you know, giving his life story and your friendship.
He told me stick to rapping, cause I'm good at it. He always talked about trapping, he was a hood addict. He used to play football, he was QB, said everybody in the state cuz knew me. Number 7, Scott.
For people who don't know, can you kind of tell briefly who he was, and also what did his rap sound like?
Jermani Hogg, Jermani Robinson was my big cousin, man. And like, he rapped just to play around. Like, he wasn't like, oh yeah, I'm finna make a career out of this rap. He more so rapped just to talk about it. Like, he lived the life that rappers rapped about. That was, you know, that was his life. And he would be like, man, I'm finna rap, man. Everybody wanna rap about my life anyway. Jermani was like he was a motivator, man. He was a dude that every time you see him, he would be smiling. Even if it was a devious smile, it would be like, cuz, what you up to, cuz? And he'd just be like, oh, you know, boy, I'm just putting some plays together. But he always had something up. He was always, more than anything, outside of his street persona, he was a great father. And to me, that's what I always remember him most for, is that he put it on the line for his kids, no matter what. Even the day that he was murdered.
On October 17th, 2005, Jermani Robinson, then 33, was shot when he went to investigate gunfire he heard coming from the basement he had converted into a music recording studio. His 13-year-old son and two other men were also shot but not killed.
He, like, jumped in front of his son, and so they wouldn't kill his son. Like, they killed him and shot his son a couple times, but his son didn't die. But that's just how he was and who he was. He was, so to me, I could tell you several adventures and stories of his street accolades, but it would never measure up to the man he was as a father. And that's what always will be remembered by me the most.
Yeah. Someone else important to you, although in a different way, is a guy you did kind of a one-off song with, MC Hammer.
The law's coming, better talk baseball, look, a fight with the best of them. You don't want to mess with him, still got the North, got the East and the West with him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
We had Timbisa Mshaka on the show a while ago, who was a early sort of hip-hop journalist in Oakland. And she was talking about Hammer in his early days, sort of before when he was, you know, before the major deals and stuff. How influential, I mean, you were pretty young, but how influential was Hammer in the Bay when he first came out?
Everybody wanted to be like Hammer. I mean, Hammer had a cartoon, man.
Hammer, Hammer Man, Hammer. Whenever there's a crime, some crooks are gonna do time. They all better beware, because the Hammer Man will be there. Here's...
Imagine being a kid and you see right after Bugs Bunny on Saturdays go off, MC Hammer come on with the dancing shoes. You a kid, man. Hammer was huge. Hammer was the first rap concert I ever went to at Berkeley High. He shot, I think, Too Legit to Quit. He shot the video, but he had like a concert, a free concert. Hammer was huge, bro.
And what was it like to finally get to work with him years later?
It ain't even just working with him. It's having the ability to call him. Till this day still is exciting to me. Mm. Like, I could be in a room with people and I'd be like, yeah, you know, just got off the phone with Hammer. I'd be like, MC Hammer? Like, Hammer. And that's a surreal feeling to me, man, based off the fact of, like, his name is Stanley, my name is Stanley, and I identify with what he was doing for the city, how passionate he was for Oakland, California, how him giving people jobs and hiring hundreds of people and helping them take care of their families and helping out the city so much, man. I went on a path of philanthropy, definitely in his, like, you know, through his legacy of what he was able to do. And he came along and coerced me through a lot of it. Some of the backpack giveaways and everything that I do in the community when it comes to giving back, he's the main sponsor. Like, he's one of the main guys that comes out. If I'm doing a turkey giveaway and I'm giving out 1,000 turkeys, he's bought about 300 of those turkeys to give away. Till this day, MC Hammer will always be one of my favorite people in life.
And so as a rapper, you had a unique experience. You know, I've talked to people from Houston who had a similar thing happen where all of a sudden a movement that you are a part of, that you're kind of a founding member in, becomes, you know, breaks nationally. For you, it was, you know, Hyphy, sort of all of a sudden, it seemed anyway, to those of us not in the Bay, you know, was like a national phenomenon. And then almost just as quickly, it wasn't. What was that like for you to go through? And what did you see that do to the people around you?
Success changes a lot of things. And not even success when we talk about financially, or we talk about success in the terms of awareness. To go from regionally being talked about to reading a blog from Paris, or having someone fly from Australia to come do an interview with you, and you're like, y'all heard of me in Australia? Like, y'all know who I am? That does things to people's psyches. I've seen it change a lot of people. Some people aren't able to bounce back from that change, you know? Fame is more powerful than heroin, because once you stick that fame needle in your veins, it does something to you. It puts you on a high that's non-comparable to anything that you've ever been through. You're like, y'all know me. I'm him. I'm that guy, that influence. You the Pied Piper. They follow you. But when that's taken away from you, and now you're just a regular Joe Smo, some people can't make that adaptation. They don't understand the transition of the total opposite trajectories. And it kills them. It destroys them. We've seen the movies and we've read the books of the guys who go big. Perfect example. The movie Trading Places. Mm-hmm. Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. Where they took the homeless man and made him rich. And they took the rich man and made him poor. The homeless man who Eddie Murphy played was able to adapt.
I'm very sexy. And people would come and say, Billy Ray, you're so sexy. And not understand my sexuality.
I know.
I'm a very sexy man.
You was in the tank last night, bragging on your limousine. You the motherfucker I was gonna call.
Yeah.
Motherfucker. Moi. That just happens to be my limousine outside. Why don't you go take a look at it?
The rich man went crazy.
He was wearing my Harvard tie. Can you believe it? My Harvard tie. Like, oh, sure, he went to Harvard.
I mean, if he's being driven around in my car, he could actually be living in my house. Maybe he's even taken my job.
You know, for all I know, right at this moment, he could be fondling my fiance.
You expect me to live after being a millionaire several times over? I'm homeless now. I'm poor. I don't have any, nothing. And you expect me to be sane?
Yeah. And it's the same thing with recognition, even if that's not.
That's the fame.
Tied with money.
The same,
yeah.
Same entitlements you feel like, you know. But there are those of us who can still go and say, man, it was never, if it was never about the fame to you, then you could carry on.
Right.
To the next chapter of your life, till you up at bat again.
Obviously, something that happened in the middle of that was the Ghost Rider situation.
The streets know just what this is. Ghost riding whip up and down the strip. The Ghostbusters, they the police, always want to pull an overforce peak.
Ghost Ride It is Fab's 2006 single from his unreleased album, The Yellow Bus Rider. The song got caught up in two separate, though possibly related, controversies. The first was anger over its advocacy of the practice of ghost riding, throwing a car in neutral, then jumping out and walking alongside or riding on the roof as it continues to move. The second was that the car from Ghostbusters was featured in the song's video, which led Columbia Pictures to threaten legal action and the eventual pulling of the video from major outlets.
When you get a new car, and you're feeling like a star, okay, okay, what you gonna do?
And I'm not going to ask about the specifics of it. You already have a glazed look in your eye,
right?
Like you've been asked it a million times. Is there anything about that situation that people don't know that kind of hasn't been picked over from your perspective?
Nah, everything was pretty out there. I actually used the car that was in the real actual car from the Ghostbusters movie.
Oh.
And Columbia Pictures owns the copyrights to that car. It was rumored that they didn't like the way that it was being displayed in the Ghost Rider video. I think it flirted around the lines of copyright infringement or tampering with something, whatever,
right,
it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
They asked for it to be pulled from, you know, all Viacom outlets. So that would be the BETs, the MTVs, so on and so forth. But you know, just like I know, anytime anything is taken away from the masses, that makes them even want it that much more. So it actually only made the record that much bigger.
Oh. That's interesting. So you have Son of a Pimp 2, a new album. Why do a sequel to this now?
I think I've built up enough experiences to talk about it again in a way that is interesting. I mean, I've done several projects in between The Baydestrian and this project.
Yeah.
But none where I've devoted as much focusness and concentration as I have with this project. I've been working on this project for about 4 or 5 years.
Wow. So the cover is, you know, an update of the original Son of a Pimp cover.
No, it's not.
With your mother instead of your father.
It's different covers. It's like, it's that. It's the same format.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, the same format.
Yeah. It's the same format.
What's the thinking behind that?
Because the first one was an honor to my father.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to immortalize him through picture so he'll live forever. And the second one is the same with my mother. In between those things, my mother has passed. So everything that I did with the first one was my father on the cover, my mother on the intro.
I was in the game, through the game, what I did. I ran a little paper. I sold drugs most of my life, you know. Game was good to me. I kept a square job. I've been working for 30 years. You know, I keep it to the grind, make sure if I don't have the dope money, I got to show check one. You know, I had to keep the check.
I flipped it with this one. So now my mother's on the cover, my daughter's on the intro.
Thank you for the people who bought the album. This is Son of a Pimp 2, coming live from Oakland, California, the Bay Area. Rest in peace, Mac Dre, and my daddy's favorite rapper, the Jacker.
And I'm sticking to that concept. I'm following the same guidelines and blueprints that helped me create that first one with this one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of songs on this record about your formative years, about growing up, about the beginning of your career.
I was born in 82.
January 23rd. I was my mama's only child, and to my daddy I was third. And my clothes didn't fit, and my shows wasn't thick, and my flows didn't spit. I was rambling words, not making any sense. I was stuck on the curve with a pocket full of lint. But my
that was part of the concept as well.
Yeah, yeah, just sticking to the same guidelines. Like it was just me 10 years later of what I'm doing, and me up until this point, the maturation of me, not only as an artist but as a man.
And, you know, without getting into, you know, the specifics of all of the features, there's a lot of features here. And a lot of, you know, on almost every tune, there's one or more features, including lots of high-profile people.
Among the long list of album features includes Raekwon, Jadakiss, Snoop Dogg, Lupe Fiasco, G-Eazy, Crooked Eye, Bun B, Too Short, B.O.B., and former Cypher guests Kendrick Lamar and Paul Wall.
Why go that route?
I wanted to show, if you look at the first album, it's a lot of features.
Mm-hmm.
They're just local.
Right.
You know, some of the features on that first album are local guys. They were like the people who I grew up idolizing. E-40, Yuck Mouth, Messy Marv, Mr. Key, The Delinquents, Mac Maul. These are people that are on the first album. So I wanted to take that same approach and just nationalize it.
Mm-hmm.
So go out and go get my friends and associates who are on a much broader level and on a bigger scale. And I was able to do that with this project.
Nice. And, you know, Still Feeling It on that record is about the Bay Area sound and kind of how it lasted so long.
The sound that we started, they still in it. But that just let us know they still feeling it. Yep, I'm still feeling it. I'm still feeling myself. I'm still feeling myself. Yep, I'm still feeling it.
Right, and how your careers lasted so long. What accounts for the longevity of the Bay Area scene?
It's innovative. Originality will bring forth longevity. They'll always love the one that created it. Too Short has never changed his style in 30 years, ever. He has the most simple, difficult style in the world. And he's never changed it. And there have been several artists that could rap way better than him and more lyrical, more diverse, who even tried to take his kind of style and approach. They'll never be Too Short because he's the innovator. He's the originator of that. And it's the same with the Bay Area. They'll always love the originators. And you'll have a core base, whether it's super big, widespread, if your horizon has expounded past Bay Area boundaries, they'll still love you where you are, you know?
And Coming Down on the record has a lineup of Houston all-stars, including Zero, one of my personal favorites.
Gorillaz.
Dig these blues, homie. Damn right, I'm on 22s, homie. The bass hitting so hard, 11 times a week, I gotta replace the fuse, homie. It's a jungle inside my ride. Alligator skin is like everywhere. I'm allergic to regular weed, so if it ain't kush, homie, don't put it in the ass. Yeah, I'm riding around and I'm getting...
Oh, my God. And Zero, if you're listening, you're welcome on the show anytime.
Hey,
anytime. What connections do you see between Houston and the Bay?
It's you said it earlier. When a chopped and screwed Houston whole movement went nationwide, it was their time. I think we came like right after them.
Right.
It was their time. The whole world got a chance to see what DJ Screw had influenced and inspired the rest of the world to do. And they had their shine. They had a great run. It was dope. With us, it's unfortunate that it takes one of our pioneers to die to get that attention. So you see a DJ Screw in his passing, how big Houston became. You see when Mac Dre passed, how big the Bay Area became. And there was a lot of comparison between the two cities, and they're like city cousins. Like, you know what I'm saying? We're definitely, Houston is very similar to the Bay Area. Like, I've gone down there, I've been down there, I've stayed down there for a long time. And it's very the same. You know, the culture is different. Maybe only the dialect and temperatures may be different, but those guys are, that's our bay, like in the South.
Yeah.
So I was able to reach out to the spokesman from that area. The hardest one, I mean, to be able to get Zero was like, yo, that was so dope.
Right.
Because he don't do nothing with nobody.
No, Beyonce, I think, was the last feature, like, I remember.
Zero, along with Houston rap stalwarts Bun B, Kirko Bangs, Willie D, Little Kiki, Scarface, Slim Thug, Trey the Truth, Paul Wall, and jeweler TV Johnny Dang, appeared in the video for Beyoncé's No Angel off her 2013 self-titled album. Zero has done a number of features since then, primarily with Houston artists, though also with artists outside of Houston like Rick Ross and Boozy Badass.
He don't rock with nobody.
Yeah.
He just like, man, he stay in his own lane. So for Zero to actually just say, Fab, I got you, baby. Don't worry about nothing. It's good. That was dope, man.
Yeah.
So to put him, Slim Thug, Paul Wall, and, you know, Uncle Bun on the record.
Yeah.
That certified it.
Yeah. Perhaps the most personal song on that album is Brother to Brother.
Dear little brother, I'm writing to see if you got my last letter. And if you did, honestly, that's my last letter. I get the point, I see you too busy and don't want to be bothered. It's just weird how we share the same mother and father, but yet you treat me like a stranger instead of your brother. How could you hate me so much when you know that I love you?
Bab's brother, who was frequently in and out of prison, was sentenced to life in 2010.
And, you know, you mentioned things in your life about it. Is that actually about your relationship with your older brother, or is it kind of inspired by it?
No, that record is a true testament and true chronicles of my real life. That record is all based off prison letters for the past 25 years of my life between me and my brother.
Has he heard the track?
I don't think he heard it yet. I kind of like told him about it. I think you told bro about that record? My other brother had told him about the record. I don't know how he's going to take it. But we've had these conversations and we've talked about it. But to me, I think that's the most personal record that I've ever done. Outside of a song called Mother Like You, which was a record I did for my mom right before she died. But Brother to Brother might be one of the greatest songs ever, just off sheer reality. An artist that could write a story like that conceptually is dope. But to actually have it based off real life, real prison letters, like everything that I say in that song, I really have letters of him saying it. So that goes beyond artistry because the depiction of it is real, but the scenario and the situation is even that much more realer when you really go into dissecting the things that we're saying on that record.
Yeah. One of the things about your songwriting, you talked about how you have like the rapping side of yourself that just will freestyle all day and the poetic side that wants to, you know, sit down and compose poetry and, you know, really think about what you're doing. Can you talk about the songwriting process? What role does each of those sides of you play in making songs?
I think at the end of the day, I'm like a Langston Hughes, a Hemingway, a Robert Greene, a Sidney Poitier, some form of Shakespearean, a Roe. I'm just a writer. I'm an author. And I love writing. But I love all different styles of writing. I think the nostalgia of writing, turning a thought into reality, is what drives me the most. Whether I'm writing in haiku, or whether I'm writing a short story, or whether I'm writing a skit, a comedy skit, just the ability to turn some of the thoughts that flow in my mind into actual scenarios in real life, that's what shapes me as an author. Like, that's what gives me my true. Now, they may be different. Like, I may be writing some hardcore horror rap, like, type stuff, or just a hard story, and then I may come back and write a soliloquy about the essence of a butterfly, just something, you know, that was always one of my gifts from like English classes to when we would have creative writing. Like, my stuff would always be far more extreme than the other classes. My other classmates, they would be like, okay, we wrote about what we did over the summer. You wrote about what the summer did to you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just certain things like that, man. With a pen, man. Like they say, the pen is mightier than the sword because you're able to cut far more than people.
And whenever we have people who are really good freestylers on the show, I like to try to get into their head a little bit. When you're freestyling, what kinds of things are you thinking about? Like, what's actually going through your head? How far ahead are you thinking? Are you thinking about rhyming, or is the rhyming part automatic and you're thinking about subject matter?
Kanye West said it best the other day on Ellen, DeGeneres show. And I can't remember the word he said, but he said when he visions things, he just sees colors.
Mm-hmm. The synesthesia.
I have a condition called synesthesia where I see sounds. I see them. Everything that I sonically make is a painting. I see it.
I just see words. So, like, when I close my eyes or when I freestyle, I just see words. And I'm just grabbing words. Now, my natural MC-ism makes those words rhyme. So I'm actually grabbing words that rhyme. But that's not the main focus. The main focus is I see an ocean of words and I'm fishing. Some may make sense. Some may be words that I tried to grab and only grabbed half of it. So I didn't pronounce it right. I only said this part of the word, but you kind of knew what I was saying.
Right.
After you listen to it and you analyze it.
Host right for rappers. Host right for rappers. No love. I got your show right, toe right. Most types for most types know a loss with most dykes and knifers. I did life with lifers. Spit rhymes with ciphers. I got homies.
But whatever that gift is called,
mm-hmm.
That's what it is. That's what I see. I just see words.
Is that something you can turn off? Like, you're walking down the street, not rhyming. Do you still have that ocean of words kind of in front of you?
Yeah, because everything that I do is just not a rap. You know, like doing this interview or any interview that I do. My intention is not just to rap. It's to communicate, to converse cordially in a matter of making the masses understand what we're saying and breaking down certain things that they wouldn't understand from my element in your worlds and making them come to a comprehension of both of our worlds, the maturation of conversation. So it's always words. I'm a logophile. I'm in love with words.
As I can tell, because you use the word logophile.
I mean, you know, not many people may know what that word is, you know?
Yeah.
But that's what it is.
Yeah. I wanted to get into kind of the business side of your career for a second. Record industry, obviously, is not what it was even when you were first putting out records, you know, 10, 12 years ago. What do you have going on business-wise aside from recording music, which, by the way, you do at a incredible pace?
Thank you. We have so many different several ventures, and I say we because everything that we do is a team effort. My brother and I have started a clothing line called The Dope Era. He does all the artwork for the clothing line. I make come up with some ideas. It may just be random, maybe like 3-4 in the morning, and I'll come up with a saying and just be like, bro, bring this to life. And he'll put it together. He'll put the, you know what I'm saying? He's a crazy graphic designer, all self-taught, like didn't go to school for none of that, like just taught itself. And our clothing line taken off. It took off where we're from, you know? A lot of people like, yo, I'm trying to get some of that. I need that stuff. So you see it. You see, like, I just left the Breakfast Club doing the Breakfast Club interview, and Angela Yee had on the Yee sweater. Like, so, you know what I'm saying? Like, so that, I mean, that's dope to walk in there and be like, oh, hi. Like, you know what I'm saying? You supporting us. So that's one of the ventures. We have this thing called Creating Change, which is something my uncle implemented from all his trials and tribulations of dealing with street life, not always on the positive side of the gate, but the negatives of saying, let's adapt Gandhi's philosophy and be the change in ourselves that we wish to see in the world. And it starts with creating change in the communities that we come from. It starts with redirecting the mind state of the youth, letting them know what we're tempted and what we're haunted by in the ghetto as far as materialism has really no true value. Everybody can tell you the price of something. Seldom and few will know the true value of that they're pricing out. So we're trying to re-educate, first uneducate the kids. Let's undo, unlearn what it all with all we have learned, because we've basically learned some BS in the ghettos. We've glorified some of the most haunting things and daunting things. We've glorified selling drugs. We've glorified the dope man as a leader in the community. And we've gave him this fictitious certification of a great man. But we'll condemn the drug addict. In the same sentence, they're the same. One's addicted to selling dope. The other's addicted to using dope. Where's the difference? Now, pointing out the difference is where we create change. Because they both have to stop. Because they both have led to the delinquencies and the destruction to the communities that we wish to rebuild. So creating change is a small group of us who go out and take the kids to amusement parks, and we take the kids to baseball games and monster truck events and several other things, of letting them know that these outside parties do care about your well-being, and getting them to realize that sense of thinking is not going to get you anywhere. So somebody has to care. So that's another venture.
Yeah.
Then the songwriting for others and so on and so forth. So there's other opulent ventures that I indulge in to keep afloat.
So as a songwriter, I know you worked on Loyal. These hoes ain't loyal, no they ain't. Whoa, these hoes ain't loyal, yeah, yeah. Black girl with a big booty, if she a bad bitch, let's get to it. I've also interviewed Bobby Brackens, who, you know, worked on that.
Yeah, that was his record.
On that tune as well, yeah.
My role when I contributed to Loyal was they wanted to get Too Short on the record. I wrote Too Short's part. Fell in love, turned into a wussy. 24/7, he was eating that pussy. But these hoes ain't faithful. A nigga like me, I had your bitch on tape, though. I've been knowing not to trust these hoes. I get bread, get head, and fuck these hoes in that order. Don't switch it around. Relationships change, it's so different now. No high school. And I added some other little stuff to the record. But Bobby had already had the record. And Bobby's a star, man. Like, I love that kid, man. I've watched that kid grow up right before my eyes, and to see where he is now with the songwriting, with him still doing stuff for himself, it's dope to see things happening for him. So that was my contribution to that record, and I was just happy to be a part of it. Like, when the RIAA certified it, I was like, yo, it's dope. Like, you know what I'm saying? When you look it up, and my name's a part of the record, great, you know, great thing to add to your resume.
Yeah.
That's just one of the songs.
Any hopes for more songwriting, not for yourself?
Oh, for sure. Like, I'm super involved in, like, I'm too far deep now. This new project that Too Short is about to drop, maybe in the fall, it's called 3 Decades a Game. He actually saying that it's his last album, his last studio recording album. I know we've been through that road before with Short.
Yeah.
But at 50 years old, I think that this is actually like his last studio record. Not saying that he's going to stop recording songs and verses for people, mm-hmm. but about doing a whole project. So I was able to A&R and write this whole project for him. So that was dope. It's a great experience. I'm so humbled by him allowing me to be his pen, but also be some form of a liaison to him to learn the game. Who else better than to get it from the godfather of independence.
Yeah. What was it like to write in his voice? I've talked to Paris about this because he wrote a record for Chep D, which right. is sort of a similar situation, someone you looked up to.
Right.
What was it like to write for his voice, in his voice? And also, did you coach him on the actual recording?
We did everything together mm-hmm. With this whole project. And not just this project, but like for several years. Like mm-hmm. I remember when the first time he came out, when he came to me, he was like, we're in the studio, he was like, just write it. I'm like, write what? Just write my verse. I was like, what? I'm like, write for you? Like, boy, I've been waiting to do this forever, because I always would emulate Too Short. Like, in the Bay Area, you got E-40, Too Short, Mac Dre, Andre Nicotina. And those are the guys that we grow up idolizing. Those are like our, that would be our Mount Rushmore. So I had Short flow. I had it down pack already, baby. Like I said, it was already had your cadence and everything, baby. I've been waiting to do this.
Right.
And he liked what came from it, and it's been on ever since. Like, he's taken me all around the country and showed me so much stuff about the game, man, that you would never, you could never imagine, man, what under his tutelage, what I've learned. And I want to say he lost his mother on Mother's Day this year. And it's been kind of hard for him because short, like I was saying earlier, it's damn near like emotionless. So him having to experience this has made him kind of like realize how much mom's meant and, you know, that emotion, like I haven't seen in him. So I just want to send strength to him and you know, and the powers of get better and some levels of understanding. You know, I got nothing but love for him from a son perspective, from a little brother perspective, from a student to the teacher. And sometimes the guy that everybody goes to needs someone to go to at times.
Right.
So I just want to extend that to the rest of the world.
And finally, I couldn't let you go without asking about your cousin, Shitty Sean.
Beast Mode.
Beast Mode, a.k.a. Marshawn Lynch. So one or two quick things about him. Did he tell you that he was retiring? Because I know it came as a surprise to pretty much everyone in the wider world.
Yeah, the immediate family knew that he was retiring.
Mm-hmm.
He actually won a season over. We felt as if, you know, when they didn't give him the ball, we was just like, yeah, it was done. It's over. But it was still a check on the table to be collected. We're going to get that money. So he went and, you know, he got that. And that was the plan, yo. I'm going to walk away, man. I'm going to walk away on my own 2 feet. You know what I'm saying? I don't have any known hindering injuries. I'm of complete mind and sound, and I walk away at the top of my game, able to utilize my influence to inoculate beautiful possibilities and other scenarios in life after football. And that's what he's doing now.
Is he really done? There are rumors that, oh, he hasn't resigned his papers yet. Maybe he's coming back. Like,
he's done.
He's done.
You know, for the regular season.
Okay. What? And just one last thing about him, and I appreciate your time on this. You know, seeing someone you know, there's music industry rich, there's rapper rich, and then there's NFL rich.
He's a different kind of rich.
He's a different kind of rich. What was it like to see an immediate family member get that rich from close up?
I've seen it a few times. I've seen it with Jimmy Rollins. Real, real, real close family member. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, blood wouldn't make us, you know, any tighter. So I watched Jim get a crazy check for baseball. Then I watched my homeboy, CC Sabathia, get more money than all of them combined. Like, you know what I'm saying? But to watch Sean come from where we come from, it couldn't have gone to a more deserving person whose hard work has been nonstop since Pop Warner football and going towards his dreams. So to see the fruition of Lil Shitty, the NFL superstar, everybody's talking about him, the whole world is talking about him, to him pulling up in the same neighborhoods where we used to play hide and go seek and a Lamborghini, like, wow, like, that's crazy. And for him to still be Little Marshawn, in a sense. If you didn't know him and you weren't familiar with the Beast Mode and you saw him, you would think he just was a regular hood dude, regular guy from the streets, regular dude from North Oakland, California. Because he doesn't put it out there like that. He doesn't wear like a crazy amount of jewelry. He doesn't wear, you know, he's not flamboyant. He's laid back. He's very reserved, and that's just more motivation to keep striving, man, to let you know that dreams do come true.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man.
All right. From his opening name drop of Georg Hegel all the way to the ending hints about his cousin's football career, this was an interview that went all sorts of unexpected and often delightful places. I loved hearing about the early days of his career with Jim Archer and Monty Hall, and equally about the ins and outs of making his brand new album. I think we got a real in-depth look into the people, places, and ideas that made Fab who he is. Join us next week when our guests will be Nice and Smooth. They're celebrating their 30th anniversary as a group, and we'll take them through it all, from their beginnings teaming with Bobby Brown and T. LaRock, all the way to their current tour. Trust me when I say there are heart-stopping moments in this episode you won't want to miss. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cipher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecipher show if you enjoy the program and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cipher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cipher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I see an ocean of words, and I'm fishing.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I could tell you several adventures and stories of his street accolades, but it would never measure up to the man he was as a father.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Fame is more powerful than heroin.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Yeah, my brother. Yeah, I'm a pimp, but I don't pimp black women.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Keith Harrington.
A Langston Hughes, a Hemingway, a Robert Greene, a Sidney Poitier.
And an extra special thanks to Michelle McDevitt of Audible Treats for making this happen.
And in no form or fashion am I trying to compare myself to these prophets, but
we'll see you next time around on The Cipher. Shit, hold on one second. One second, I gotta think of how to start the sentence. Think of a day.